minutes past 4 o'clock, so let's get started. I'm Craig Johnson, an actor and a director from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We have a lot of different Hamlets right up here. But today we're talking a little bit about some of the building blocks of acting. What are some of just basic things? Now, acting is usually something that, you know, people go to school for. They might start studying it when they're in high school, go on to college, and then maybe get a graduate degree in that too. But we're just going to take care of things in less than an hour right here too, so that'll be just fine. One of the main things just in acting is when you're acting, you're using your whole body, so we're just going to start off doing a little bit of warm-ups. So anyone who wants to join in, these are just easy sort of stretching kind of things that we're going to do too. And Sam doesn't know it, but I'm going to ask him to do some of these too, if I just can't think of too many others as we're going along here too. But a lot of times in acting, what we like to do is release a lot of tension. A lot of people carry tension in their shoulders too. So if we just do some forward shoulder rolls, we're just going forward a little bit. You know, so wherever you think you carry tension, you're going to want to release that before you go on stage. So you do that several times. And then maybe you reverse it and you go the opposite direction. You go back right there. I've known people who carry tension in their toes, so their toes are always clenched or something like that. Isn't that bizarre? So part of it is being in touch with your own body and knowing where that happens. Maybe just going to one side over here, and you can even put one hand on the side of your head, hand out like that. You can feel that muscle stretching right there. You can go ahead and you can do that on the other side. Done that and released, and maybe just roll. We're not rolling all the way back, that really isn't good for you, but roll back and forth. And that really is connecting your head with the rest of your body, which is what you want to do in acting too. So to get out of your head and keep the mind and body all united then too. The alignment of the spine is another big thing too. So if you just sort of open your feet just a little bit too, you can sort of loosen up in your hips a little bit. And then we're just going to sort of drop over halfway. So boom, we're just coming down like this. Bend your knees just slightly so you can kind of bounce right here just a little bit. Let your arms go and your neck go so you're just flopping over. You can even go back and forth just a little bit like you're an elephant or something. And when you release that spine, then slowly we're just going to go ahead and stack back up. So we're slowly rolling up. You can feel in your spine and your back there, vertebrae by vertebrae, going all the way up. And you can feel your head floating up, even going up higher. Well, imagine there's like a little string right there, just even going up. You can even do this if you wanted to. So you feel that string going up. Oh, pulling you so you're standing up straighter. So you feel like maybe you're an inch taller than before you started. Maybe there's another string just right from the center of your chest. Well, you can suddenly feel that too, just sort of pulling you forward. And then imagine your shoulders extending out. You have the broadest shoulders in the world. And this is a great sort of start, ready position to act, where you're just open. You should feel relaxed right there and just ready to jump in. Like if you were on a sports team or starting a race and you were ready, set, go, the ready position is where you should always be. And it's from here that you can start creating your character or start acting right there. But the body is just one part of it. The other main part of it that you're going to be using would be your voice. And then what you mainly have to start with is just your breath. Oh, guess what? We've probably all been breathing wrong since we were babies. Babies breathe correctly. They breathe from their diaphragm, just right below your rib cage. You can feel that the big muscle right there is your diaphragm. So instead, to breathe wrong, which probably a lot of us do, when we take a big breath, you know, this happens, and our shoulders go up, and you feel all of these muscles locked right there. And then you speak out over that. Well, that doesn't seem quite so good. You don't want all of that tension right there. But if you breathe from your diaphragm, like singers know all about this, so it feels like your stomach goes out a little bit. Can everyone tell the difference? You sort of feel that? So it's almost sort of the opposite of what you're doing. So your chest and your shoulders and that, they stay comfortably relaxed, but in and out. Let's maybe breathe in on 4, hold for 4, and breathe out on 8. So So, and we should feel our diaphragm going out, and one, two, three, four, hold, two, three, four, out, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, repeat, two, four, hold, two, three, four, out, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Those are just really good breath exercises that you can just do sort of on your own for, and you know, just to even sort of release stress and sort of calm yourself or something like that. There are a million different sort of vocal warm-ups that we can do. Let's just, for a moment, just play just with pitch. Our great range that we have in our voices, which we don't often use, let's just start as high as we could go and let it drop down and come back up. So what we're doing is going, right?
Yeah.
As we go from falsetto to, you know, chest. And you know. So here we all go. So look at all those notes that you have to play with, my gosh, too. And when you support it with that breath kind of work, when you're all relaxed like that, boom, you can play Hamlet then, too. There are a lot of different sort of tongue twisters and different things you can work on just to get your tongue sort of nimbled up. Do you have any that you like to do?
A great one. If everybody wants to grab their tongue and hold it out, and say your name. Say, my name is Sam Boswell. Say it again. My name is Sam Boswell. And now sing it.
My name is Sam Boswell.
And chant it once.
My name is Sam Boswell.
Everybody just go around and see if it feels any different to say, my name is Sam Bardwell.
My name is Sam Bardwell.
It does feel different.
And never said that. Even your own name, to see if it...
My name is Phil Carlson. Mm.
My name is Ellen Carlson.
My name is James Carlson. My name is Janet Carlson.
My name is Peter Gustafson.
My name is Tom Pulliot.
What did I say?
James Carlson. Carlson.
Close enough.
My name is Jeannie Hare.
My name is Craig Johnson.
Mm.
Mm.
Do you
want to
say your... My name is
Helene Faithfully. Crisp. Everybody sounded very crisp.
Yeah, I could feel that, you know, all of a sudden, yeah. Things were released, we, you know, our throats were open, boom, that could come out. Great. Sit down, have a seat. Well, there are millions of things like that, that just as actors that you can go through and learn. And a lot of different actors do warm-ups like that. Where's Ben Swenson-Clatt? I just took that picture of him. Up on the mountain. So a lot of these kind of stretching things, this is similar to what you might do in sports. It's similar to what you might do with yoga and a lot of other different practices like that. Getting in touch with your body, the vocal warm-up, you can isolate and do different kinds of things to work on your volume, your diction, your articulation, your breath. We did a little bit of that, the range, the resonance, the pitch, and stuff like that. And most actors have some kind of routine that they do even as they go through. So you might learn a whole battery of these in your classes. You might have a 15-minute warm-up that your acting instructors will go through before you do anything in school. But a lot of actors will pick and choose what works for them even before they go out on stage or something like that. I see people backstage as I'm waiting to go on, you know, doing a lot of this kind of stuff too, doing that right beforehand, maybe just pacing, maybe just running through their lines, just standing, the few deep breaths, working with their diaphragm, and then going out on stage. Do you have any things that you like to do, just like right beforehand?
Mm-hmm. And it changes with every show. That you know, there are specific demands for, you know, when you're playing a younger character, there are certain kind of, you know, leathery limbs you need to stretch out in a different way than you would if you're playing an older character, and how you need know, for me, it's a matter of going through that movement vocabulary, which is unique to that character beforehand. But certainly I have a regimen of breath exercises and speech exercises that just to make sure my diction, no matter what I'm playing, is always, you know, supported and clear.
Supported and, yeah, ready to go then, too. Any questions just about that as sort of the basic thing to keep your mind, your voice, your body all connected and in the ready, set, go position?
So, I have a question.
Yeah.
So when you're preparing to go on stage, do you start imagining yourself that character? Is that, when you're starting to go into that before you're on stage as you do this? When does that happen?
Well, so it could be that in addition to doing just this kind of physical stuff to get your instrument ready,
right.
You might start thinking through that, sort of the story of your character, like what happened, like right before you go on stage. And a lot of times I do that too when I'm acting, you know. This is where I'm coming from, this is, you know, the time of day it is, this is the story that I have to tell. Which is actually, already a little digression, but a really famous story is Claire Bloom, British actress, elderly actress now, but she was cast as Juliet when she was 16 years old, which was unusual, very unusual, particularly since she was playing it at the Shakespeare Memorial Theater, what became the Royal Shakespeare Company. Very excited about it, learned the whole part, got there and realized she was working with all these older, more experienced actors, and got increasingly nervous and more tense and everything just as opening night approached. And the show started on opening night, and she was just terrified and wanted to bolt from the theater. The opening scene, which Juliet isn't in, happened. She got more and more terrified just standing with Lady Capulet and the nurse backstage. Older actresses, very well known. They were just talking to one another. They got set. They start the scene, and then they call for Juliet. So she's standing in the wings, Claire Bloom, age 16. And she just said to herself, it's all right. I just have to remember, I have a wonderful story to tell. And that's what she said, and she went out. And she became a star. She was just like one of the most renowned Juliets in the sort of mid-20th century. Well, I'm just going to put the screen up here a moment, and let's just think about acting just for a moment, see if we can make a little list. Why would we want to, or what are some of the things that we learn when we become an actor? Maybe even things that are not even associated kind of with theater, but they're sort of general life skills that would be terrific to learn to have. Yeah.
How to walk in someone else's shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a little bit about their life. You
to
know,
sort
like
of be the other.
Be the other.
Yeah, but I loved what you just said, yeah. To focus on other people, to learn about others, and to be able to walk in their shoes.
Courage.
Courage, yeah. Most people say standing up and talking in front of a group of people is one of the most terrifying things commonly among people. You learn how to do that, yeah. So, well, let's just put that, that's an example of the courage, and speaking in front of a group. So you learn that. You learn, I could have just put public speaking, I suppose. That would have been a lot easier. And we use that in many different areas of our life, too. What are some of the other things?
Voice modulation.
Yeah, just some of the things that we were just working on in here. Just your voice, how to use your voice, how to project. How to speak clearly, how to speak eloquently, how to speak persuasively in front of others.
I react spontaneously to
different
situations.
React. And going with that, I would say on your feet, problem solving. Mm-hmm. If something happens on stage, that you don't just sort of, you know, melt into a chocolate mess on stage, but you just solve the problem and you move on. You realize, I have a wonderful story to tell. Pick up with the next part of the story.
Working well with others. And
yeah.
With
it's teamwork. We talk about that so much in athletics, but the teamwork that you need to put on a play, so I would say, like, trust building and being a trustworthy person, you learn that by doing?
Openness.
Openness, yeah. Two ends?
So.
Openness, yeah. We could talk about, you know, emotional vulnerability or just awareness. Oh, goodness. Who knows what I'm writing? emotional, you know, being aware, being having access to those kind of emotions, understanding those.
Imagination?
Yeah, imagination.
Going to some different, maybe even completely fictional place.
Yeah, sort of accessing creativity.
There's something about story here, you know, sharing story.
Yeah, uh-huh. So even just storytelling mm-hmm. skills. Being able to tell stories well.
I think because of that, can you distinguish authenticity somehow?
Mm-hmm.
And along with be the other, I think it's similar, but empathy. I mean, I think.
Great, 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 great. Yeah. Is really understanding the other, understanding many different others. I'm going to add discipline.
Self-forgiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And forgiveness of others.
Yeah. Yeah. accepting, whoops, that's a C, criticism. That you both have to be emotionally vulnerable and accept criticism, balance that. So if someone is talking to you about your work, they're talking about your body, your voice, how you look, what you're doing in the scene, and it's not just your director doing that in front of the cast, but then someone will come to the show and publish it in the newspaper, put it online, it'll be there forever. So being able to handle that while at the same time being open and emotionally vulnerable. Well, those are just a few things I think that you'll learn when you study acting or when you practice it, which makes it, I think, a really valuable skill no matter what you're going into, is to learn a little bit about that. So I'm glad you guys are here to do that, too. Let's maybe move on. I haven't even forgotten what I have next, too. Probably something thrilling. Oh, yes. Let's just go back here for a moment. Another little exercise. If people want to stand up again, you know, we were doing some physical kind of stuff. Let's right now just do a reaching thing. So it's just we're stretching and we're reaching. We're reaching high. We're reaching. And that feels good. And that limbers us up once again. But now we're actually reaching to get something on that shelf up there. It's really, really high. We can just barely get it. Oh, we're a little kid and it's a bunch of cookies, and if we can just get the cookies before mom comes back in the kitchen, then if we can get it, we could even stand on a chair. If there were only a chair close by, we could do that, and then we might be able to get them. Oh, wait, we're not actually a kid at all. We're a French maid, actually. We have a very short little skirt on, too. There's an old gentleman in the room. We're trying to get that little box up there at the top. That little box. Oh, but look at my underwear is showing. You know what? Actually, we're not feeling very good. We're feeling something might happen. The medicine is right up there, but every time we reach for it, no, that's going to be work. No. Okay. That terrible accident might happen. One last time, let's try. Let's get it. We got it. Oh, thank goodness. Sit back down. You just demonstrated the building blocks of acting right there. This is what we did. I love this expression. It's Robert Cohen, an acting teacher, who says, get your goat. Well, what we're talking about, we've just reached, but just reaching is just calisthenics. We were reaching for something. What's stopping us? How can we get it? And did you get it? The want, the objective, the intention, that's the goal. We have to get whatever it is up there. The other is the O right there. What is the other? It could be the other person in the scene, or what is the obstacle? That thing was so high up, we could barely hardly get it. The T stands for the tactic. How are we going to get it? Now, in this particular instance, we weren't acting with anyone. Tactics come into play when you're doing a scene with someone. And there are two kinds of tactics, induction or threat. Well, that just simply means induction tactics are win-win. You're going to seduce someone. You're going to charm them. You're going to tease them. You're going to flatter them. win lose is the other. You're going to force them, you're going to yell at them, you're going to punish them, you're going to hit them, you're going to murder them, you're going to annihilate them. So one wins, one lose, or win-win. And sometimes you use win-win if you want to kill somebody. Just take a bite of this beautiful apple, says the wicked stepmother or something like that, right? So it's just like, great, oh, just give me a coin. You can have the beautiful apple. It's a win-win situation, but it's in order to kill. Or the reverse happens, too. So it's the carrot or the stick. It's the reward or the punishment. And when we got that bottle of medicine, thank goodness, that was our enthusiasm for victory, our expectation. How important is it to achieve our goal? Did we get it or did we not? And what happens? When we go to see plays, we are just watching people imitating human behavior, trying to get something, trying to achieve their goal, trying to find their way around the other, whatever the obstacle is, either going with win-win or win-lose tactics, and we're waiting to see if they achieve their victory or not. That's really kind of what it's all about, which is why Katharine Hepburn, you know, said about little Shirley Temple, well, she's 4 years old and she can do it all. Let's take a look at another example from a play. The Miracle Worker is the story of Annie Sullivan, the teacher for Helen Keller, deaf, dumb, blind, trying to get through and communicate to her. Annie Sullivan really just has one objective in all of The Miracle Worker, and that is to figure out a way to reach Helen Keller, to teach her some kind of language, to communicate with her. So that's her goal. Her obstacle is partly herself, because she had 17 operations on her eyes, so her own eyesight isn't good. That's an obstacle. That is also an advantage that gives her some insight, if you were, into what Helen Keller might be feeling. The parents don't think she's going to succeed, so that's an obstacle. And Helen herself, not only are her disabilities a huge obstacle, how can she get through to a child who can't hear, who can't see, who can't speak? But Helen herself then has become a terribly spoiled child. She's almost like a little wild animal who just wants what she wants and stumbles around. So the tactics that Annie starts off with, this actually looks like they're fighting right here, but the goal of this particular scene is make a frowny face and see if Helen will do that. Helen can only just feel the face and feel the happy face. And if she feels the happy face, she gets the doll then. That's a win-win situation. But Helen doesn't really like playing. She wants what she wants right then. She doesn't understand. She doesn't get it. She doesn't even eat with a fork or a spoon, even though that's what she's trying to do. So Annie Sullivan goes to win-lose tactics. I will crush your fingers around that fork and make you sit there. I will pull you back to the chair. I will throw water in your face to get you to sit there and eat like a normal human being. And it's only when she can do that and get those kind of controls around can she start doing any of the teaching that she needs to be. And this goes on throughout the entire play. You just watch this battle of trying to achieve that goal. When finally, at the water pump, it clicks, and Helen realizes that the signs that Annie has been doing and that she just keeps repeating, that what that is the word for water, the thing that she's feeling coming out of the pump. And she turns, and suddenly she realizes what this woman, who she thought was her greatest enemy throughout the whole time, is her dearest friend. And so when you get to the end of the play, there's barely a person in the world who doesn't just start weeping away at that moment. And it's a moment of the expectation, the victory of achieving that goal right there. So this is one of the clearest examples, I think, that I know of just one objective going all the way through win-win and win-lose tactics all the way to this moment. Actually, I've directed the show a couple of times, which you can tell because we have a different Helen Keller right there after a couple of years. very tough, cynical guy who was up there calling things in the booth, you know, at the end too. And so he had to do the final sort of music and light cues and stuff like that. And he just kept sobbing all the time, every night, you know, because it was such a moving scene to just watch those people go through that. So goal, obstacle, or other, how you get around it, your tactic, what you're going to use, and then the expectation of victory of having that happen. Oh, we get to play Zip Zap Zop. Everyone up. Oh, great. You guys know it. Okay. Zip Zap Zop. Tell us how you play it then. We have it right up here, but you know.
Well, somebody starts, and uh-huh. they go like, this is something, they go zip. And then
I go zap.
Zop.
And then you start again, yeah.
Like zip, zap,
zap,
zip.
Zap.
Zop.
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 How about we act with our whole bodies now? Let's do it once again. And let's get, yeah, even okay. if you want to have a sort of a different kind of motion. And 1, 2, 3, you started before, go again, yeah.
Zip, zop.
Zap.
If you're doing it as a game, then we do, you're out, you know, and yeah, you're down, black, smaller, smaller. Okay. Let's just keep going, go for it.
I'll forgive myself for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Zip.
Zap.
Zop.
Zip.
Zap.
Zip.
Zap.
Zop.
Zip.
Zap.
Zop.
Zip.
Zap.
Zip. Zap.
Zop.
Zip.
Zap.
Zop.
Zip.
Zap.
Zop. Zip. Zap.
Zap.
Zip.
Zap.
Zap.
Zip.
Snap.
Zap. Zip.
Zap.
Zop.
God. Great, you guys. Good, 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 good. Sit back down then. Okay, what are some of the things that this game teaches us? What does it teach us, acting-wise?
Well,
pay attention.
You have to pay attention. The focus, the concentration in Zip Zap Zop is extraordinary.
You have to react to other people.
You have to react to other people, what they're giving you. Yeah.
There's a script.
There is a script, yep. We were all off book immediately. Great, we're memorized, yeah.
Eventually, you have to do multiple things at the same time. If you're moving and speaking and thinking, mm-hmm. and you're trying to mm-hmm. balance all of those.
We could even do, you know, if we wanted to do it, to stop at some point and say, let's repeat that exact same pattern. Oh my gosh, who did I do, you know, to first time? So you have to, so the patterning of that too, connecting with your body vocally, we're creating an ensemble. There's an energy level that we were all automatically matching. So we're all able to do all of these basic acting kind of things. Zip Zap Zop is, of course, one of the most famous of many, many, many millions and millions of acting exercises that are done in school, and they're used for a lot of different related kind of things, a lot of improv kind of things. Use Zip Zap Zop quite a lot. Let's do another one, observable truths. Observable truths. So we're just going to be in partners, sit facing one another, and you're just going to repeat things that you see, things that you hear, things that actually happen with your other person. Like someone might say, oh, you're wearing a blue shirt. You repeat it. I'm wearing a blue shirt. You're wearing a red shirt. I'm wearing a red shirt. You smile. I smile. You smile. I smile. You pointed at me. Oh, sorry. Let's start again. You see? So the idea is we're not going to say you're mad, you're happy, anything like that. We just have to pay attention to the observable truth. Pairs. Find pairs. Everyone wants to play.
You have shoes on.
Remember the example up here when people start hearing comment on that.
You're one thumbnail shorter than your. the gold wedding ring. And both of your shoes are tied.
Both of my shoes are the first time. And
I'm on a dark stained wooden chair, and you have white socks.
I have white socks, and you have
socks.
Oh, yes. I am
black socks, and you have two different
rings.
I have
two different rings.
I have green chairs, and you have green initials. Something other colored eyes. And you have very white teeth.
Okay, let's hold right there, too. We got two, you have two ears.
We got that one out of the way.
Yeah,
I know, yeah. See, and these things, it seems so simple, but it's actually kind of really hard. It takes a little while to sort of get into it. And one of the things that I was going around sort of, you know, kind of directing people a little bit to do is to see what people are actually doing. Like if someone starts laughing, to say, you're laughing, and to be able to acknowledge that. So again, what does it teach us? A few things.
To be observant.
Observant, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To listen.
Yeah.
Closely.
To listen, because you have to repeat it back. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you have to really receive that information, repeat it back.
If we're just doing truths, we can't judge it. It's not a judgment, it's just
no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a lot of those different things, and there are millions of different kinds of exercises like this that get people to focus on their scene partner, what's actually happening, and to sort of build what that scene is about from the actual reality of it.
Well, and Craig, what I found is that I didn't want to simply state in a common voice, you know,
mm-hmm.
blue shirt, blonde hair, et cetera. It's like, I wanted to put something else in there.
Yeah.
You know,
and so what,
you know, is there
a response
point
in
of view?
You're using gestures.
Two
Your
shoes.
Voice has a lot of breath in it.
Yes.
My voice has a lot of breath in it.
Yeah, it was hard to just be in a kind of
clinical.
Dull conversation. There
so
had to be
mm-hmm.
something else there.
So if we were in an acting class and we had a pair of people up here starting to do that, we might start saying like, nope, take that out, just be neutral. What do you see? What do you see? And then you can add different acting things in there. Someone could stand up. You stood up. I stood up. I folded my arm, you know, whatever, you know, and just go on from there. So there's a lot of ways then you can start building and manipulating from that, and you can start building an acting moment out of that then too. So let's start talking about building a character. So you're an actor, but you're going to be playing a character. Well, what are the basic steps you do? Well, it would be a good idea to read the whole play. Not just your lines, read the whole play. Then step away from it, read the whole play again. Then after you do that a couple of times, then obviously you're stepping in and you're taking a look at, okay, what does my character say in the play? Because that's what the people out front are going to hear. What does my character do? Because those are the actions the people out front are going to be watching. What do other characters say about your character? What do they do to you? Do they kill you in the course of the play? Let's pay attention to that. Yeah. What do the stage directions say? And maybe one of the things to think about that is the audience won't be reading the stage directions. You'll know those. And you have to be really careful about the information that's in the stage directions, if it's something that you're doing or if it's just a description, and then how you're going to achieve those stage directions if it's not something that's actually in the text or in the actions that are going to happen. There are a lot of different ways you can go about starting to build your character. One of the things is to just do a character list, like you see right there, where you're just listing the really obvious things. Now, a lot of actors don't do that after they've been doing it a while because they figured out, you know, they know that Hamlet is a guy. You know, he's a prince. He's Danish. He's single. His father is dead. His mother has just remarried his uncle.
Student.
He's a student.
Mm-hmm.
And you you should be able to do that and just maybe fill up a couple pages almost immediately in a notebook or something like that, if you're doing that kind of thing, both about your character, and then you might start thinking of, well, what year is it that we're in? What is the season? Start thinking about, is it hot or cold out? What time of day is it? Some of those things you can break down sort of scene by scene. Or the other thing, similar to this, and a little bit on what we just did too, is to make two columns. Start with the givens. That's a lot of this stuff. What do we know about the character? All of those different things. We start listing all of those going down. Those are the truths about the character that we definitely know that are in the script. The constructs are some of the choices that you're going to make. So those would be some of the sort of emotional states maybe that we started doing just a little bit of in this last little exercise to say that he's quiet, he's sullen, he's depressed, you might put over here, for Hamlet or something like that. He's angry, he's frustrated.
Yeah. When you started here and you said read the whole play and then step away and then start to think about it, I started thinking, in real life, a character does not know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Even in the next minute, let alone in a month or a year throughout the play, doesn't know if he's going to die and how. How do you know and then unknow that to play the character in an immediate way?
I don't know. How do you do that, Sam?
Yeah, get lucky. I wager that that's the art of it, is to believe it's new for the first. There's a great poem by T.S. Eliot. Beginning again at the beginning for the first time.
Yeah.
And it's that notion of forgetting that you know all these, especially that you know the words you're supposed to say.
Yeah.
And partners are the biggest help. You know, even noticing things, like noticing for the first time that Craig actually has his arms crossed this whole time. I never noticed that before.
Yeah.
And, you know, that indicates something new to me. And and everything comes kind of in a new light based on that. You know, I thought all this while that he liked me, but his arms are crossed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just trying to find new things. What a fine clavicle you have. I never noticed that.
You know, I'm not pressing my arms anymore. But I do want to kill you.
Yeah.
How are you going to do that?
Yeah. And it's sort of being able to put all of those pieces together and then go back to the start of the story and create the illusion of the first time is what the rehearsal process is all about, and then what you have to recreate night after night in performance then.
Great.
Yeah.
Or just one of those things that I think is so funny is that, I don't know, it'll be interesting to know next time you go to see a play, if you can tell what time of day it is in any given scene ever. I just challenge you to at one moment take yourself out and say, are these actors playing the time of day? And just because I saw Craig in a Chekhov play in which that was very clear, the time of day that was being played in all of the scenes. And it's a real fine, you wouldn't think about it because normally, you know, it's a fine layer of texture of acting that is so often overlooked. And that's one of the few times I remember noticing, wow, craft points. I know what time of day it is. I know what's night. You know, which is, especially in something like Shakespeare, you go and it's always kind of the tense part of the day is what it basically feels like. But.
And if we think about even just basic things like the weather, to make sure the entire acting ensemble is aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we can imagine here, if we'd been at Holdman for whatever, the last several days, and it had been just raining nonstop, how would that affect even just our behavior in this room? If the temperature were 10 degrees hotter and the humidity many, many percent higher, how would that affect how we just did a lot of those exercises? If it were 20 degrees colder, if it were snowing outside, how would we play that too? Well, we wouldn't have the windows open, so everything about the environment would alter and change for that too. And that's, just as you were saying, all of those things are really hard things to create in an ensemble and to pay special attention to as a director if you're trying to create that entire world right there. Well, here we've got a little bit of a play right here. Let's see what we can figure out here. Just make a few sort of acting choices. Henrik Ibsen's really famous play, A Doll's House. Here are some of the opening moments right here. I'll read the stage directions. Anyone want to be Torvald, the husband? Anyone want to be Nora, the wife? You guys? Do you guys want to do that?
Sure.
Okay, you can be Nora. Yeah, do you want to be Torvald? Just
go
read it
James.
Right now.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. So it's the beginning of the play. We've all just come in. Christmas Eve day, late morning. Nora enters, humming. With lots of Christmas packages, she listens at the door to the study. She smiles. She puts the packages down and takes out a bag of macaroons. Mmm, probably dipped in chocolate, too. She eats one and continues humming. Torvald calls from the study.
Is that my little skylark I hear twittering?
It is.
Is that my little squirrely rustling?
Yes.
When did my little squirrel come home?
Just now.
She hides the bag of macaroons and wipes her mouth.
Oh, do come out, Torvald, and see what I bought.
You shouldn't disturb me.
Bought?
Torvald enters. And then you continue on, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did you say? Has my little swan bird been fricking away money again?
No, not so very much. And surely we can let ourselves go a bit. It's the first Christmas. We don't have a script to scrip and save.
Yes, but we can't be extravagant.
Of course, Torvald. Whatever you say.
Oh, my little songbird mustn't droop your wings. My little squirrel mustn't sulk.
Takes out some money.
Nora, Nora, look what I found.
Money?
And so much of it.
Tosses bills in the air, laughing.
One, two, three, four.
Catches the money, laughing.
Oh, thank you, Torvald. This will help quite a bit.
Well, I should hope so. More closely, yes, you seem awfully guilty today.
Do I?
Yes, look me in the eye.
Well?
Has none of your sweet tooth been indulging in the shops today?
I don't know what you mean.
Perhaps a digression into the pastry shop?
Certainly not.
Or a side trip to the confectioner's?
No, I would never!
Or the tiniest nibble at a macaroon?
Nor Torvald, honestly!
That was only joking.
You know I would never go against your wishes.
Great. Thanks, you guys. That was really good. That was really nice. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So what are some things we learned about these characters if we were playing them?
Newlyweds.
Yeah. No, they've actually been married a number of years, so they have three kids. It's the first Christmas that they don't have to scrimp and save. He just got a promotion at his work. You'll find out just a little bit later.
They have fun with each other.
What do they? How do they have fun with
joke
each other?
Joke and tease.
They joke. They tease.
Call each other names.
They have little something. Names for each other. Yeah.
Nora.
Or certainly Torvald does for Nora.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nora lies.
Yeah. About eating anyone.
Nora right. lies. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Torvald has rules about these things.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And Torvald checked on it, but then let it go.
So yeah. Nora lies again, insists on that too. I can't help but think of some biblical story where someone lies three times, you know? So they've been married for a number of years, and even about little things, she lies. Wow. And yet, they have a lot of little names, or he has a lot of little names. They do what? They sort of play together, don't they?
Yeah, it's almost
they
like
play games with money.
Children's games.
Yeah, uh-huh. It's like, my gosh, they're in a doll's house. So it's like they're almost not grown-ups, even though you find out that they're married, they have three kids, and having fun little names, laughing together, playing games and things like that. What's wrong with that? It's Christmas, you know? So as an audience watching that, we're probably both kind of charmed by the scene a little bit, and we have this slight sense of being disturbed by it, because we see, even within the first page, that these people are lying to one another, too. And we see that they lie about a little thing.
You've got this like, slight sense of impending doom.
Yes, uh-huh. And it's really one of the hallmarks of a lot of Ibsen's plays are set up like this, where it's like, Everything is perfect. The world is wonderful. And then there are little clues that maybe not, maybe not. And then, of course, you know, before too long, it sort of goes over the cliff right there. Acting-wise, anything else we want to say about that?
What is winter?
It's winter.
Mm-hmm.
It's Christmas. Christmas Eve. It's late morning, so we have a time of day. Lots of packages.
The relationship with money there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is something to pay attention to. So, like, as an actor, you would, like, read that and think, like, oh, better track that. He has lots of rules.
Mm-hmm. Including he expects her to be happy and bright and shiny. You know,
mm-hmm.
Don't drip your wings.
Yeah.
So she sometimes doesn't look him in the eye.
Yeah.
She seems to enjoy burnt meals.
Yeah. She seems to kind of like playing the games and stuff like that. Yeah. She works the system.
We know this is, it feels European. I mean, obviously, it's like Christmas and Torvald seems Scandinavian beyond that.
Well,
you know,
Ibsen is Norwegian. And so it takes place in Oslo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this would be an example of a really wonderfully rich opportunity just as actors that you could go through just in this amount of text and create a lot of those sort of givens and constructs and start tracking some of this little bits of information and just in like the first page like this, let alone the next 80 pages that happen, in a very detailed, rich script like this that will keep unfolding and give you a lot to work on in rehearsal just for yourself, with your scene partner, with your director, and with the ensemble right there. Here's another one. I just did a Neil Simon play called Laughter on the 23rd Floor. This is a play that Neil Simon, American dramatist, we know Neil Simon, yeah. So he writes lots and lots of comedies, and it's about his early years when he was working for Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. So he was a comedy writer in New York. So it's in New York at that time period. And this is a group of writers. And then one of the writers, the one Neil Simon is based on, is Lucas, who does some direct address, talks directly to the audience, and introduces a lot of the characters. I played Kenny Franks. So just reading through this, this is what it says. Kenny Franks walks in, neatly dressed, sports jacket, tie, raincoat, tortoiseshell framed glasses. He is surely the most sophisticated of the lot. There's a stage direction where the author is telling you something, but you have to find out a way to play it then, too. So Kenny comes in, Time Magazine. Did you see this? This week's Time Magazine. Pope Pius approves of psychoanalysis. This means from now on, confession will be $80 an hour. Lucas says, go ahead and read it, Sam.
Kenny Franks, boy genius. They say he was writing jokes for Jack Benny when he was 14. I wasn't allowed to stay up for Jack Benny when I was 14.
Let's just go around. Read Val.
Val, a woman, a man?
A man, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
You think maybe this Pope thing would make a sketch for us?
Well, I think we'd all have to take communion first. You get the big word.
It'd be circumcision?
Mm-hmm. Kenny takes a pill with a cup of water, then Milk jumps in.
So, Mr. Redmond, what kind of pill are we taking today?
Nicotine tablets. Now I can get cancer without having to smoke. He pours some hot water in a mug and puts a tea bag in it. Okay, now let's build a character just based on some of this information that we have here. A lot of it is given right up here. Oh, look it, he's all dressed up. Well, whose responsibility would that be in the production process? The costumer. The costumer would do that. I knew that in this particular show, don't tell anyone back home, we did not have a very good costumer. I didn't think she was very good. I've worked with her before, she's a nice person, she's not a very good costumer. I didn't know that this would achieve what this says. So there's a sense that I should walk on stage and it should look like I'm more sophisticated. So this is an ensemble comedy. We can see all of these people are on here, boom, boom, boom. Okay, how can I do that? I said, hey, how about instead of a tie, that Kenny always wears an ascot. An immediate flag for the audience, too. People wear ascots, you know, it's like Noel Coward. Yeah, Thurston Howell III, right? Or someone who thinks he is, you know. And if he's also a comedian kind of guy, too, but he wears that, too. He has a sense of fun, a sense of play about that. Think like Tony Curtis in Some Like It Hot when he was, you know, pretending to be on the yacht and stuff like that, too. So they said, oh, great, that's a good idea. So I thought, taken care of. So that sort of took care of that. Well, we see that he's someone who tells a lot of jokes. He comes on, and he makes a Pope joke right away. He makes another Pope joke right after that. And then he makes a cancer joke. He's a character who makes jokes. Well, we knew that probably going in. This is all about a bunch of joke writers right there. What do we find out right here about him?
He's a boy genius.
He was a boy genius, so he's been doing this for a long time. He was writing jokes for?
Benny.
Can anyone do a Jack Benny?
I'll bet you can.
You can,
do
can I'll bet.
Can you do a Jack Benny gesture, though?
Rochester.
Yeah, you don't, yeah. You just have to do that. So I saw that, and at this moment, and I told John Catron, who was playing that, it's just like, sorry, in the middle of your speech, right here, I'm going to do a Jack Benny thing. So I went and I hung up my coat, because he just came on stage. He says, Kenny Franks, boy genius, did they say he was writing jokes for Jack Benny when he was 14? And I just walked down and did that. And I got a huge laugh from the audience, too. And I kind of set up, okay, this is where this guy comes from. So there's a physical characterization that you're going to add that the audience will feel really good about because they'll all know exactly who it is.
Audience members over 50.
Yeah, yeah. But, it got, you know, and I was able to do it like about three times. Three is the magic number in comedy. Three times in the show. It got a huge laugh each time it happened. It's like, oh, yes. My character, Kenny, is actually based on Larry Gelbart, who is the creator of MASH. See, a lot of these games. But see, no one knows who that is. But I thought, like, and so everyone said, oh, you were the Jack Benny character. It was just like, well, that's fine. I'll go with that. So that was another thing that I added right here. As we skip down a little bit later, we have this little moment. Mr. Vitamin, what kind of pill are you taking today? Nicotine tablets. Now I can get cancer without having to smoke. So what is Kenny trying to do?
Smoke.
He's trying to quit smoking. So he just takes those pills. There's no other reference to it later in the play. But I kind of thought, okay, a lot of times if people are trying to quit smoking, they have like some substitute. This is an ensemble comedy. We're all like standing around telling jokes and stuff like that because I'm a little bit of a laugh whore. Sorry, inappropriate words. I thought, okay, well, how can I stand out? How can I be specific? Each of the characters in this play should come up with some physicalization, some, you know, something that's going to make their character unique. So I thought, okay, he's going to take that, he's going to say that, and then I pull out a Tootsie Pop. And I have a Tootsie Pop. I have three of them in the course of the show. I have three because I have one in Act 1, one in Act 2, and there's a second one in Act 2 because I throw one in Act 2 at someone else when I'm mad at them, so I throw the Tootsie Pop in their face. So if you do something like that, you have that. That sort of attracts a little bit of attention, right? You can use that to sort of point and wave, sort of everyone's arguing and say, hey, wait a minute, and you've got a Tootsie Pop in your hand or something like that, and you can crunch it. You can do a lot of different things. So it's sort of like if you're in a restoration comedy, a classical comedy, like Ladies with Their Fans, where they point and they do, you know, and they do stuff like that. This would be a modern day equivalent. The third thing, or I can't remember, third or fourth thing that I added that came into play right in here is all of these characters are telling jokes, and they sometimes seem a little mean with their jokes, or they say mean things about other people. That's kind of the world of this play. They're hard-bitten kind of joke writers. They just toss those things out. But I kind of thought, you know, you don't want to listen to someone else make a joke and then laugh and say, that was a good one. You can't say that. That isn't your line. And laughing at someone else's joke repeatedly just to sort of ingratiate yourself. But I didn't want to make it seem too mean-spirited. So every once in a while we do joke, 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 back and forth. And if one like really landed, was really good, I would just turn and go like that. Just sort of like, score one for you. That was a really good joke. Which as writers, doing this, you've got that sense of competition, one with the other, and then you are also able, but you are also able to sort of acknowledge, I really like that, I really respect your talent, that was a really good, that totally landed. So those are just a few of the things, here I'll show you some pictures right here, to create that physical, vocal, visual, sort of behavioral kind of choices, you're still trying to do your goal, your obstacle, your tactics, your expectation. They should always be supported by the script, contribute to the action, positive, active, they should be bold, and surprising, yet inevitable. It's surprising to see an adult pull out a Tootsie Pop on stage. But you think like, oh, yeah, but he's trying to stop smoking, so he's doing that instead. So, you know, because he wants to, really wants to smoke. Oh, wearing mascots, that's kind of silly. Oh, yeah, but he thinks he's like really sort of sophisticated, I guess, or something. Jack Benny, well, that was his mentor. That's who we first started with when he was young. He loves Jack Benny. We did this several times in the show in Act 1. I came out at the top of Act 2. My first line, this is Neil Simon plays, you come out and you tell a joke right away. And I turn to the other character. The audience is laughing, laughing, laughing. I look at him, and he goes like that. This is great. The end of the play, my last big joke that I have in the play, it's a party scene, so I'm kind of drunk. You know, we're all kind of drunk right there. And I say something really funny, and I think, like, that was really funny. And I finally laugh at my own joke and give myself one and fall down in a chair, too. So audiences like that, too. So it gives a sense of variation and completion and kind of go full circle with it. Kind of makes sense? So that's how characters are built. You can do it that way, and you're also doing it by finding your goals, your objectives, your tactics, and your expectations throughout there. But what about subtext? What about if there are things that aren't spoken? We have two people who want to read Vershinin and Tusenbach from Chekhov's The Three Sisters. Any readers here?
I will, sure.
Okay, go for it.
Great. Be Vershinin. Why don't you be Tusenbach? Sure. Here we go.
Well, if they're not going to give us any tea, let's at least philosophize.
I actually can't see that.
Oh, sorry. Anyone else then? Go for it.
Oh, yes. Let's. What about?
What about? We must dream of what life will be like for those who come after us in 200 or 300 years.
Well, they will fly in balloons, certainly. Styles of clothing will change. They'll discover a sixth sense and make fantastic use of it. But all the while, life will remain quite the same, difficult, mysterious, happy. And even after 1,000 years, people will still be sighing, ah, how hard life is. And all the time, exactly the same as now, people will be afraid of death and not want to die.
How shall I put it? It seems to me everything on Earth must change, little by little. It's changing as we speak. In 200 or 300 years, even 1,000, it's not a matter of time. A happy life will come. We may not share in that life, of course, but we are living for it, working for it, even suffering for it. We are creating it, that happy life. And in that alone lies the purpose of our being and, if you like, our happiness.
What was really funny is as we were reading through that, I think there were like 4 people in the room who turned and looked at the clock. Right, because really, is it really that interesting? It's kind of a little bit interesting. Okay, they like to philosophize and stuff like that, but it seems very general. It seems just kind of boring right there. But if you know that this is part of a conversation, oh, they're not going to give us any tea. Okay, so they were expecting tea. It's like a big party scene right there. And so there's a lot of people sitting around, including the three sisters are in the room as well. Vershinin is very much attracted to one of them, Masha, who is married. Tusenbach has long been in love with Irina, but she just doesn't love him. She likes him, but she just doesn't love him. These two guys, their subtext is a win-win tactic. They are trying to impress, to charm, to seduce, to make love to their girlfriends who are in the room. So that's what's going on.
So the room is small enough that the sisters can hear them.
Yeah, so it's just a big group scene, kind of like we are right now. So this conversation is going back and forth. But what you have to discern as an actor is what's going on underneath here. What the scene is really about is these two guys trying to come up with, like, great kind of, you know, the sixth sense. Let's talk about that. Yeah, I'm so smart. And let's imagine that. What must that be like, too? Am I impressing Irina? Not so much. Doesn't work. Never works. I saw it once done just so beautifully where Vershinin, in this pause, where maybe he realizes, okay, I'm just not quite reaching Masha. How shall I put it? And as he talked, he just sort of went over, it could have been even earlier in the scene, and just sat down. It's like, you're Masha. He just sat down and he started talking, and he was right here next to her. And he just kept saying those different things, you know, and in that alone lies the purpose of our being, and if you like, our happiness. And so if you can stage it in such a way where the audience can see that, but no one on stage really notices just something like that or something that happens there, because the very next line in the scene, there's a stage direction that says, Masha laughs, and Tusenbach says, what are you laughing for? And she says, I don't know. I'm happy. Mm-hmm. So we have this, he says, he ends with happiness, and she says she's happy right after this sort of moment happens. And being able to discern that and come up with a physicalization that would communicate that to the audience would be a brilliant moment of acting. Mm-hmm. And that's why Chekhov plays are not boring like this if you have the strong subtext of the indirect action, the unspoken action that's going along underneath, and that's where the romance, that's where the comedy, that's where the tragedy is in those parts. We're just at time, so we're done here now. Thank you. You're all wonderful actors. Thank you, guys.
You did great. Love it, love it.